Welcome to Exploration 1, Module 7. And whilst you may be thinking that we are ripping through the modules at an incredible rate, although we did sort of get stuck on 6 for a while, I will still be answering questions about any material from the previous modules if anybody wants to ask it. And I will also be, we'll be working back through the other labs and stuff now that the remote bundle is pretty much operational. We're still having technical problems getting the Eagle server to be communicable. It just seems to be a pain. And we're not sure how we're going to resolve that. So we'll let you know how that's going to happen. The Eagle server is basically this dicey Linux box that the Cisco people hammered together with all this different stuff on it. And we might try and find an alternative to stuff on there because it's not the easiest thing to get to fit into our network topologies. Before I start covering Chapter 7 and the data link layer of the Open Systems Interconnect Reference Model, does anybody have any questions, queries, comments, or anything they would like to say, talk about, expound upon? Just a note that for anybody... Go ahead. Sorry.
Sorry, I waited too long. The binary to decimal, the exercise you put up today, the tutorial bit of it was most helpful.
Ah, thank you. And I apologize about the line endings. Pranav has brought that to my attention, although I was asleep when his email came in, so I fixed it this morning. It now has DOS end-of-line conventions, so it will open in Notepad and things. If you were looking at it on a Mac or Unix, you probably wouldn't have had much trouble. But if you were looking at it on Notepad, the line endings would have been munged. So if you already got yourself a copy and it all looked messed up, get yourself another copy and it won't look so messed up. Now, regarding the tutorial bits and pieces in that, if there's anything that people want me to add to that document, like if anybody can think of any topics they want a couple of paragraphs on, I'm quite happy to expand that document out so that it becomes a written reference to all the stuff I talk about, rather than just having me talk about the stuff, because having the stuff in my head isn't particularly useful unless people get to the point where they can understand it and all that sort of good stuff. Now, has anybody got any other pending questions about the subnetting stuff, or shall we deal with that once you've all had a shot at the exercises and see what comes up from there? Alrighty, let's start on the stuff in Module 7. Yeah, I think we do. I think you guys do the exercises first and see how you go. And the answers to those either go direct to me if you have my email address, or they go to caviinstructors@gots.net, which probably after today, and both will still continue to work, will become cavi-instructors@qcat.org. Because we're all getting at qcat.org addresses so that you can easily see what has been sent from home and what is being sent from work. And that's pretty much almost completely operational.
Can I ask a silly question?
No question is a silly question, so no, you can't ask a silly question, but you can ask one that's perceived as potentially a silly question. Go ahead.
Is there any possibility of speeding up the TTS that comes out of the chat window, because this is my netbook and it's Microsoft SAM at a horribly slow rate and it doesn't seem fixable?
Yes, it is. You go into under the setup dialog, there is actually a text-to-speech tab. Just let me whip in, because once I go in there I can't talk, and I'm just find out exactly where it is and I'll tell you what you have to do. Okay, I have the answers to your questions. You go into the... he'll come down in a minute. You go into the setup dialog and you control tab twice to get across... Good morning, Drew. Glad you could make it. You control tab twice to get across to the text-to-speech tab, and you basically have the option of selecting... the speech engine you're going to use, whether you want to use eSpeak or any other SAPI 5 compatible voice, and there is also a volume and rate slider in there. and you can either wind Sam up, or you can grab a copy of eSpeak from eSpeak.sourceforge.net and drop that on and use it instead, whatever is your desire. eSpeak is not particularly pretty, but it is fast.
I love it, because since I've been using NVDA a lot, I've gotten quite used to it, and I love it. It's very responsive.
Yeah, unfortunately, we've discovered that there are licensing incompatibilities that prevent it being ported to the iThing. We were really looking forward to having that in DaisyWorm as a Daisy reader. We're going to have to look at other alternatives now, which is really sad, because it's GPLv3. There's a clause in the license that prevents it from going on the iPhone. Okie dokie. So, harangue me again later, Brian, if you can't find those tabs. But yeah, you can wind those pitches and speeds and stuff up in there. And you'll need to install the standalone eSpeak. You cannot use NVDA's, unfortunately, because it's sort of tied into NVDA. So you'd have to grab the other one at some point. Okie dokie. Data link layer. Anybody tell me, what layer of the OSI reference model is the data link layer? You can either say it or type it into
chat.
It's
the second layer.
We have one answer from Robert. Layer 2. Anybody else going for layer 2?
Layer 2.
Yep. Okay, we have a unanimous thingy-jiggy that says layer 2. And I'd agree with you all. It is layer 2. Right above the physical layer, right below the network layer. Sandwiched in there is the data link layer. Okay. Bit of review. Application layer provides interface to user. Transport layer. What did I say here? I made a spelling error. Transport layer divides and manages communications between processes running on end nodes. Okay. Which is a funky way to say it manages the different network sessions and stuff that are open at a particular time, and it manages opening and closing them and all that sort of good stuff. Network layer traffic network layer lets traffic travel through network, takes care of routing, etc. And I've already said that it sits between the network layer and the physical layers. By the time this chapter is finished, apparently you're supposed to be able to do the following. Explain the role of data link protocols in data transmission. Describe how the data link layer prepares data for transmission on the media. Describe the different types of media access control methods. Identify several common logical topologies and identify how the logical and physical topologies interoperate and how they determine the media access control method for that network. And explain the purpose of encapsulating packets into frames before it's put on the media. And we're going to talk about the layer 2 frame structure, even. And it's only flame structure if your network stuff catches fire. And identify generic fields. Then we're going to talk about the headers and trailers in the field, in the frames. And we're going to talk about the various fields that go in there and what they do. Okay, any questions on that before we get started? Okay, silence is golden. Now, data link layer uses media access methods and error detection techniques to ensure that data gets onto the media correctly. Anybody tell me, what is the protocol data unit for the data for the data link layer? Anybody know?
Frame.
Yes, it's a frame, okay? It's a frame, because we've got bits at the bottom, we've got frames, we've got packets, we've got segments, and we've got data, as we have previously discussed. So they're all the different bits and protocol data units, so we are dealing with the frame. A node is the term for stations at this layer. So if you say that you're talking about a particular Ethernet card or whatever, you can refer to those as different nodes, because they could be Ethernet cards, they could be routers, they could be printers, they could be mobile phones or cell phones if you're over that area of the country. Now, just give me 5 seconds. Have we got Brody with you today? Yeah. He's going to have to find something else to do until after lecture because those guys are working on the computer that he would probably... Okay. Now, one of the things that we need to talk about is, can anybody tell me what is the network topology?
It's the way the nodes are organized in the network, and it'll determine the flow of data.
It certainly can determine the flow of data. I think the other key point of the term topology is it's generally...
I'm thinking it's how the network is wired, like rings and star topologies and the that sort of thing.
I've reported it's a lost property, Carol, but nobody's seen it. I've got the faceplate here. One of a mobile phone went missing out of a training room. It was sitting on the desk, just so that you guys know the context. And an N70 went missing. I don't know what sort of person would want to nick an N70, but there you have it, or would want to pick one up. Okay, now, if we look at the physical and logical topologies, now the key point of a topology is that, generally speaking, topology diagrams is the top-down view of the network, and she's got two more batteries, guys. There wasn't anything wrong with the battery when I tested it, guys. Can you guys like debug that at the cafe or something? Because I'm trying to lecture. I've got a charger in my bag, if you need it. Well, no, it's not. Okay, now the physical topology is how the actual network is wired up. So we look at the actual layout of the physical devices and how we've documented the actual way that the wires or the signals are traveling. And the logical topology is how the data actually travels around that network. And I'll explain the differences in a second. So what we've got, for example, if you look at, if we talk about a couple of the physical topologies we have for a network, there are a couple of them. There is a bus, and a bus topology is where all of the devices are connected in on a shared media, all in a big line, and they all have access to the same shared media. If we look at a star topology tends to have a hub or a switch at the center of the network, and it has machines coming out from that star in all different directions. You also have an extended star, which is where you've got more than one star connected together. So if you've got a drop lead going from one switch to another, and you have two switches, and onto each of those switches you have you actually have computers, that would be an extended star. Now, a ring topology is where you've got machines wired in a circle, and you've got one machine connected to the next machine, connected to the next machine, connected to the next machine, and then connected back to the first machines. And the packets travel around those rings. Now, whether you are looking at the physical layout of the network or whether you are looking at the logical layout of the network can actually depend on what sort of topology you've got. Has anybody ever seen Ethernet cable together with coax?
Yes.
Yeah. Anyone else seen coax with the old T-pieces and terminators?
Yeah, I remember having to find those terminators recently. They're hard to come by now.
Yeah, ironically enough, I think I've got about 10 of them in my components box. But yeah, they are fairly difficult to come by. If anybody's seen that sort of networking, you basically had either 10^2 or 10^5 coax, and 10^2 was usually a thin 50-ohm impedance coax, and along the coax you had T-pieces, and the T-pieces would connect onto the network cards, and then at the end of each of the ends of the bus you would have terminators that would suppress the electrical reflection that would otherwise bounce back down the cable, and you had to have a terminator on each end. And if you didn't have a terminator on each end, it wouldn't work at all well, and you had to have one run of coax that ran from T-piece to T-piece to T-piece. You could not branch the chain. It had to run in one big long bus topology. Now, when you sent a signal across the coax network, and this is not a very common networking thing today, you ended up with a situation where you could actually, the packet had to travel the entire length of the cable, and that was where you could end up with a situation called a collision. Now, a collision is when one or more stations would send a signal at the same time. And this was something that was a part of Ethernet and happened quite regularly. And it was a general part of networking. The bus basically had a decreasing performance as you got more and more collision. And I don't know whether anybody remembers, but back in the old days, you used to have, as well as having a link and activity light, you also had a collision light, which would show you when a collision actually happened on the network. And when the collision light was on for a good percentage of the time, it was then time to upgrade your systems to be using a switch or a router or similar. Now, it's only of historical interest, but I don't know whether anybody realizes how expensive networking equipment used to be. You were talking $200, $300, $400, $500 for a hub or a switch. And as you would know these days, networking equipment, unless you're buying the managed stuff, is certainly not that expensive. But we were looking at like $300 or $400 for an unmanaged solution. Okay, now the other thing you've got to keep in mind is that when you connect all devices through a hub, and the hub takes it takes a signal through one of its ports, and it reflects the signal out to all of the other ports on the network. So if you're actually running a network sniffer on a hub, you will actually see all of the packets travel on the hub, and you will every machine will see those packets. So it is quite possible to have collisions on a hub. Okay, now, the key point here that I'm alluding to is that if you look at a hub and you plug all of your cables into the hub, it is actually a physical star, but it is a logical bus. Does that make any sense to anyone?
Not really.
All right. Remember how I said that if you have a bus topology, you send a signal out onto that bus topology, you get a packets traveling to every single workstation on the network. Okay, so you send a packet out, every workstation will see that packet. Whether it takes notice of it or not is another thing, but it travels out to all of the workstations. If you send packets through one port of a hub, it'll come out the other seven ports of that hub if the computers are connected to them. So as far as the network topology is logically concerned, we have a bus topology, because the packets are seen by all of the computers on the segment. However, the actual physical topology of the network is actually a star, because there are cables coming out from the central point or the hub.
Are hubs even still used these days?
Gotcha.
Not generally, but you need to know about the different topologies, because things like the ring topology are actually used. So it's important to know a little bit about them.
Interesting.
Banks still use token ring, for example. You see a lot of banks in Token Ring using Token Ring because it has reliable degradation of performance as the throughput on the network increases. Obviously, and I'll talk about why the other networks don't tend to have that. Obviously, if you're dealing with if you're dealing with a switch or whatever, the switch micro segments the network. It breaks the network into a whole pile of different segments. And as a result of that, it then causes the network to be broken into multiple collision domains, which I'll talk about in a minute.
So, okay, like, let's say you wanted to communicate...
It's all right, Josh, I've cached the question. Go on. Keep asking your question.
Let's say you wanted to communicate from one computer to another, say, workstation A to workstation B, and workstation B was connected to workstation A through a switch. So the packet would go from workstation A, hit the switch, and then only go to workstation B. It wouldn't go to all the other stations?
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah, you have gone quiet again, by the way, Josh. But if you've got Skype open, close it, because it might be messing with your microphone settings. If you send the packet through the switch, provided it is not a broadcast packet and the switch knows the destination of the packet, then it will only go out the port that it needs to go out. Yeah, we got your question. It's all right. Josh was talking, so I decided I would ask your question answer his question first. No, it does not go to every machine at the same time. It actually takes a finite amount of time for the traffic to travel from one end of the bus to the other. And this is one of the reasons why Ethernet has, coax has a, 10Base2 has a cable limit of 185 meters. It actually takes a small amount of time for the packets to get from one end of the bus all the way to the other. And for that reason, there needs to be what's called a slot time, which is actually a pause time between the packets. I can't remember what the actual slot times for Ethernet are, but they are a couple of milliseconds or so.
Okay. So if you're saying that, come back to collision domains, some switches have a span port, or if you use port mirroring, what happens then? Do you increase the chances of collision?
Hang on a second.
No, guys, Grace has failed.
Okie dokie. Basically, when the... if you've got a span port or a monitoring port, what actually happens is the switch collects all of the packets together and it shovels them out that monitoring port. And basically, if you've got a station that's listening on that monitoring port, and you've got too many ports to go out, packets to go out that monitoring port, the switch will get as many of the packets out the monitoring port as possible.
Okay.
Generally, the capacity of the switch, the bandwidth of the transmission medium, and all of that sort of stuff. I mean, let's face it, if you've got 5 gigabit machines all sending at gigabit speeds and you've only got a gigabit monitoring port, you're not going to get all the packets from those 5 machines. Okie dokies. So basically, what happens is... So as we've spoken, about the bus, which is all of the machines connected together. It's pretty rare these days. We've spoken about the ring, which is where the packets go around the ring, and we'll talk about a little bit more about Token Ring later, but we won't do too much on Token Ring because it's pretty rare. We talked about the switch making little micro segments between each of the machines that you've got. Now, there are actually 3 types of switches. This is not in the notes, but I'll mention it anyway. You have store and forward switches, which grab a packet, store it, look at it, and forward it through to the particular port. You have fragment-free switching, which basically looks at the packet, makes sure that it's not corrupted or anything in any way, and then starts shoveling it through to the other port straight away without store and forward. And then you've got another form of switching which is called cut-through. So basically a cut-through switch reads the packet up to the destination MAC address, figures out where it's going, and starts sending it through the port as soon as it's seen the destination MAC address. And I assume that people would understand that cut-through switching is, whilst it's being the fastest, would also be perhaps one of the more expensive switching options. Fragment-free switching is the most expensive because it is the lowest, it's the highest speed and also lowest latency switching. Okay, now the other topology which doesn't actually get mentioned here that we talk about is a mesh, which is where we have all nodes connected to all other nodes, and that is for high reliability such as nuclear power stations and things, very expensive to implement. The internet is a partial mesh because we do have redundant links between different hosts.
Isn't mesh networking, touted for, places where you don't have a good connectivity, like rural areas or something, where they have wireless nodes?
You can do mesh wireless networks. They aren't complete meshes, but they are partial meshes. I know, for example, the one laptop per child project was actually had a version of mesh networking installed in its little laptops that they were giving out to underdeveloped countries and stuff. They were the ones with the little dynamo and the wireless aerials and the little screen and all that sort of thing, the OLPC.org laptops.
Yeah, that's where I saw the reference to meshes.
Because of the lack of infrastructure, they were looking at using mesh networks for data sharing in the rural areas and stuff, so that if you had a village full of these little OLPC laptops, they could actually share information between each other. Okie dokie.
Did it work?
Well, yeah, it worked. I don't know how many of these machines made it worldwide. There was a thing at one point where if you lived in the US you could buy one of these laptop things and you would then also fund another one for a person in a village or something. So you paid like $200 for this laptop and you funded one to go to a village and you got one. I don't know whether, I think they canned that, but it was a way they were trying to raise money for a while. I wouldn't get too excited about the hardware in the OLPC. It was a 600 or 700 megahertz AMD Geode processor. I think it had about 256 mega RAM. It ran a custom Linux with no GNOME and no Orca. You may have been able to get SpeakUp running on them, but I'd go buy a netbook. It's a lot easier. Possibly not as cool, and certainly not wind-powered. These actually had a dynamo on them that you could actually spin to charge them up. So, interestingly enough, one of the biggest applications for these laptops was actually going to be as a light source, because in a lot of these villages, unless you've got a fire lit, when the sun goes down, there isn't any light.
There was a South Bay... there was a South African company that was making big wind-up radios, had a great big crank on it, and it wound it up and spring-loaded it, and it ran for about a half hour.
Okay, because some of those radios, I've actually got one, a little handheld one has a wind-up crank on it. It's a little pocket radio, and you basically wind it for 2 minutes, and it'll run for half an hour. I use it in blackouts if I want to listen to music. Of course, it runs a lot longer on a couple of AAA batteries, but, I mean, obviously, you can wind it up. And one of the ones we had actually had a solar panel on top and the dynamo crank, and you could wind it up and run it for about 2 minutes of winding. It'll give you half an hour of radio. Okie dokies. Now, I've sort of gone on a bit long about topologies, but it's kind of important. So we've got the bus, which is the packet goes to everyone. You've got the star, which is where you've got everything wired into a centralized switch or hub. Well, sorry, switch, I should say. It won't be a hub because hubs wouldn't make it a star. Logically speaking, I should say, you've got a ring, which is where they're all wired in a circle, and you've got the mesh. The logical topology is how you look at the network as far as the hierarchical addresses are concerned. So in other words, you could look at the IP addresses and the routers and stuff and see how the logical topology was put together, which may not necessarily match the physical topology of the network. So that's the difference between the logical and the physical topology. The data link layer allows you to put packets onto the media without concerning yourself with the physical characteristics of the media or the particular contention method that you are going to use to put the packets on the media. The frames can differ from media to media, and it's important to keep in mind that as a packet travels from one network to another through routers, routers actually take off the layer 2 data link layer addresses and they repackage the packets with other layer 2 addresses as they travel from interface to interface. And this is especially true if you're going, for example, from an Ethernet link to a point-to-point link to a wireless link to a fiber optic link to a satellite link back to an Ethernet link. So the layer 2 stuff can change all the way through the network as it goes from hop to hop to hop. Any questions so far? Ah, that's good. That's what we like to hear. Media access control Media access control controls how packets get on and off the media. There are two types of media control methods. There are deterministic methods and non-deterministic methods. A deterministic method allows you to figure out how much bandwidth you're going to get, exactly when you are going to get it, and in what order you're going to get it. So examples of deterministic media control are things like token ring or the token passing bus. Now, ring topologies are used on token ring. They're also used on fiber optic or FDDI. And they are used on in another couple of specialized places. The point is, however, that with a token architecture, you send the token from machine to machine to machine, and you load the token up with a packet if you've got something to transmit, and then the packet gets passed from machine to machine to machine, and then the machine that the token is destined for removes the payload from the packet, and then passes the packet on, unless of course it's got something to send as well. There are certain networks where you actually have two rings, where you have one going clockwise and one going anti-clockwise, and that's used for fault tolerance so that you can detect breaks in the ring, because without a dual ring topology, if you got a break in the ring, you wouldn't be able to get to all of the machines on your network. You'd only get as far as the machines on just before the break. Now, it's worth mentioning that a device has a card or an interface that controls how to get the media on and off the network. So if you're looking at a laptop, you might be looking at an Ethernet card, which is usually embedded onto the motherboard these days. It's a pretty rare laptop that doesn't have Ethernet on it. You also have some laptops that have, a majority of modern laptops that have embedded wireless cards. If you've got a really good one, it's the Bang variety, BANG. Or you've got other ones that have a subset of the different wireless transmission modes. Some of the older laptops used to have PCMCIA or card bus cards. I always used to claim that PCMCIA stood for People Can't Memorize Computer Industry Acronyms, which is not true. That's not what it stands for at all, but it's funnier than what it actually stands for. And then card bus was the newest standard that was meant to supplant PCMCIA. Just out of morbid curiosity, quick survey. Anybody broken a PCMCIA or card bus dongle in their time? I've done a couple. Yep. They're very easy and very flimsy. I don't know whether anybody's seen PCMCIA and card bus cards, but they're about 5 mils thick or 7 mils thick. The PCMCIA is about the size of a credit card. And the card bus, you had the 35mm and a 55mm wide version. You could have both sizes of card bus. And depending on how the network cards were constructed, some of them had a little dongle cable that plugged in to the edge of the card, and then you had a little cable hanging off to a dongle where you'd plug the cables in, and they were usually the first thing to break, so then we all went out and bought the ones that were dongleless, that just basically had the very fat end that had actually had the connector built into it, which was a far better idea. So yeah, that's sort of your card bus and PCMCIA guffage. So they're the interfaces and things you use to get things onto the network, and sometimes you can have Ethernet interfaces on routers and things, have them on printers. They're the things that are responsible for getting the things onto the data link layer. It says that the frames differ between different media. It's actually possible to have a 4,500 byte frame on a wireless network. However, on standard Ethernet that does not support jumbo frames, it's only possible to have 1,536 byte frames. The frame has header, data, and trailer. Okay, the header comes before everything else, obviously. The data comes in the middle, and the trailer comes behind. That's why it's called a trailer. Okay, the sort of things you can have in a frame. You can have start and stop things to tell you where the frames start and stop. And in fact, on the original version of Ethernet, because it was a shared medium, you actually used to have 64 bits of preamble, which was 62 bits of 01010101, and then at the end of that you would have a 11 that would actually show that the frame was going to start. I think the preamble actually still exists in the packets. They haven't actually gotten rid of it. But it was meant to allow the transceivers to synchronize themselves to the packets coming across the media as they came across, you know, otherwise you'd have no way of knowing when a packet started and stopped on the medium. You can have naming or addressing fields. Can anybody give me an example of a data link layer addressing construct that is used on Ethernet?
What was the question again?
Can anybody give me an example of a layer 2 address that might be used on, for example, Ethernet?
You mean those MAC addresses?
MAC addresses.
Yeah, MAC address. MAC addresses are used at layer 2. And as we spoke previously, a MAC address is 48 bits long, 24 bits being the OUI, Organizational Unique Identifier, and the other part of the address being...
MAC addressing? Media access control?
Are you delayed, are you, Josh? Because you seem to be answering later than everyone else. Can you check your ping? Because...
00:AE:...
Yeah, that sort of stuff. They're in hexadecimal and stuff. Yeah, can you just check your ping? Because I think you're a bit delayed for some reason. Okay, we have the type of packet, which tells you whether it's an Ethernet 2 or a 802.3 frame. Interestingly enough, TCP/IP travels in Ethernet 2 frames, not 802.3 frames. And Novell sends stuff in 802.3. There are flow control services packets that you can stick in these frames as well. The data, obviously. And you can also have the frame check sequence, which is usually a cyclic redundancy checksum that goes at the end of the frame, and it is responsible for error detection inside the packet. Okay. The data link layer is broken into two sublayers, the media access control layer and the logical link control layer. The media access control layer uses the contention methods that I'm about to talk about to figure out who's transmitting when, and the logical link control is responsible for getting the frames and stuff onto the wire and things like the physical addresses and stuff that we were talking about, like the MAC address. Actually, no, it's the media access control layer that addresses the frame, marks the beginning and end of the frame, and the other one, it frames the packet and identifies the network layer protocol. So there we go. Helps if I read my notes. The data link layer is not defined by RFCs. If you look at the layers above the data link layer, such as network, transport, session, presentation, and application, they tend to be, for at least with TCP/IP, they tend to be documented in RFCs. You don't tend to see the data link layer documented in RFCs. You tend to see various companies and stuff responsible, and various organizations such as ISO and IEEE responsible for those standardization of packets. So you've got ISO, you've got IEEE, you've got ANSI, so those sorts of organizations. And ITUT, which is the International Telecommunications Union. Which used to be called CCITT, but they changed its name. Now, the contention rules set how the media is to be shared. So if you're looking at Ethernet and stuff, how are the packets going to be put onto the media, and what sort of order do we have? Now, we've already spoken about deterministic, where devices take turns and the link is arbitrated. Okay, no worries. All right, you just seem to be coming back after the other people, so I thought the ping was high, but it's all good. 36 is good, actually. Okay, so if we look at CSMACD, which is our method of contention used on Ethernet, it's carrier sense multiple access with collision detection. It is not CSMACD, as one of my friends used to call it. Carrier sense means that before a station transmits, it checks the wire to see if anybody else is transmitting. If nobody is transmitting, it then starts to transmit its packet. If two packets are sent at once, a collision occurs, which is where the collision detection bit comes in. If a collision occurs on a CSMACD network, the stations all back off for a random amount of time. It's actually an exponential back-off algorithm. So if you back off for 1 millisecond, the next time you back off for 2 milliseconds, and then 4 milliseconds, and I think it might be actually measured in microseconds, and then you try sending again. Basically what happens is So that's what happens when you actually get the collision. Now, it's important to note, however, that if you have a full duplex network medium, and most hubs and switches and routers can operate in full duplex mode, you can't have a collision because the switch takes care of all of that arbitration, and you end up with a case where you can actually send and receive at the same time. The reason we used to have collisions is because you couldn't send and receive at the same time on a media such as coax. Well, one workstation couldn't send and receive at the same time. If you get too many collisions, throughput decreases and you have all sorts of problems. The example of CSMACD that you usually get given is if you're at a dinner party and you start talking and somebody else is talking, you stop talking and you both wait a polite amount of time, and then one person starts talking again and the other people listen, which is not how most of the dinner parties I go to work at. Everybody just talks over each other, but that's just how it is. Not that I go to many dinner parties. Wireless doesn't use CSMACD. Wireless uses a thing called collision sense multiple access with collision avoidance. And it avoids the collision on wireless by doing a little sort of chirp thing that basically says, I am gearing up to send a packet. Can I send a packet? And then depending on how the network is implemented, if you're using an access point, the access point arbitrates and says, yeah, okay, station, whatever. You are able to send a packet, send a packet. And that's how the collisions are avoided. Token ring, FDDI, they use deterministic methods. Go ahead.
Is that why wireless speed is low? Because it has to first do all this checking as compared to wireless? Or what determines the speed?
Well, partially. The other thing is with wireless, you're dealing with a limited bandwidth. how much data can you actually get through the wireless given the width of the channels, and you've got to use either a frequency hopping or spread spectrum, which is what the 802.blah uses, spread spectrum. The other thing that slows wireless down a lot, to be fair, is the fact that wireless is half duplex. Full duplex being a situation where you can transmit and receive at the same time, but if you're using an access point and wireless stations, they can only transmit or receive. They can't transmit and receive at the same time. Point-to-point rules don't tend to require control rules because you're only dealing with a connection from one point to another. Links that tend to be point-to-point. You're looking at things like ADSL uses point-to-point over Ethernet. One of the reasons it uses that is because it's easy for ISPs to monitor and bill your volume and time. And point-to-point is also used over various serial WAN links such as ISDN and some forms of frame relay can use PPP as a transport. Now, the point they've made in the notes here is that you can actually have a point-to-point connection that is going from one point to another, logically speaking, but the packet can go through multiple end devices, and it can still be physically going all over the network, but logically it's actually point-to-point. And an example of that sort of stuff is if you have multiple people sharing the one ATM circuit, their particular traffic is separated off by the VPI and VCI numbers inside the packets. Don't know if anybody's ever set up ADSL, but over here you've got to set your VCI to 8 and your VPI to 35, and depending on where you are, you actually set them to different numbers. It's also worth mentioning that the frames contain information that is specific to a particular environment. So if you look through your notes, there's examples of an Ethernet frame, there are examples of a wireless frame, and inside things like the wireless frame, you're looking at things like the station identifier and stuff. Now, it's worth noting that physical addresses are not hierarchical. So if you are looking at a MAC address, there are 24 bits for the organizational unique identifier, and then there are 24 bits that is meant to uniquely identify your network card. So they aren't like IP addresses where you've got the network and the subnet portion. CRCs are an interesting beastie. They are basically a mathematical function that is calculated across a frame, and basically it's a specific binary polynomial, and they do a binary divide over the entire message, and then they send the remainder of the division, and it's meant to have a high probability of detecting a certain number of bit errors or byte errors in the frame. It only detects them, it doesn't correct them. And if anybody's really interested in cyclic redundancy checks, there's an article on the net called Everything You Wanted to Know About CRC Algorithms But Were Afraid to Ask, and it's published by Rocksoft, and it will confuse you. Well, it might not, but it confused me, so maybe I'm just easily confused, but it's quite complex stuff.
Like just about everything about CRC algorithms.
Yeah, there are actually two ways of calculating a CRC. One of them is to use a table-driven approach, which is what software uses, and the other way to do it is to actually use a binary shift register, which is how the hardware tends to do it. And depending on how you do that, depends on what sort of CRC algorithm you implement. But CRCs have use on things like compact discs, DVD discs, and that sort of stuff. So at the higher level, you've got CRCs on the actual sectors that come off the disc, but then at the lower levels, you've actually got a Solomon error correction that's managed to detect optical read errors, or at least it's meant to have a probability of detecting optical read errors. So these things are actually used in other things as well as data communications. There is an extremely remote probability that you will actually get two data sets with the same cyclic redundancy check. So There are very infinitesimal odds of data being corrupted and still managing to pass the cyclic redundancy check algorithm, but the odds are so high that it very rarely happens.
I've actually gotten a failed cyclic redundancy check when copying a file off of a DVD once.
Absolutely, it certainly can happen. If your discs get scratched or damaged or they have a bit of crud on them and the laser can't read them, it's sometimes necessary to clean your discs and various ways of doing that. We won't sort of go into that, but it's worth getting all of the other data off the disc before you go into extreme methods such as lint-free cloth and some Mr. Sheen, which is what we tend to use. Okay, we have Ethernet. These are examples of data link protocols. Point-to-point protocol, which I spoke to. HDLC, high-level data link control even. And frame relay. And ATM. Okay, so a LAN will tend to use a small geographic area and high bandwidth. But the same protocols that work on LANs aren't really suitable for wide area networks, which tend to have a lower bandwidth and a larger geographic area. Ethernet is standardized by 802.2 and 802.3 standards. Basically, the speed range of Ethernet runs from 10 to 10,000 megabits per second. And it's very, very popular. Does anybody not have any Ethernet gear? Anybody here not have any Ethernet gear? I'd be very surprised if somebody here says they don't have any Ethernet gear. The same sort of Ethernet frames are used across most different types of Ethernets. In fact, all different types of Ethernets use the same sort of frame. They don't tend to use the same contention methods and stuff depending on the Ethernet, so there are some slight differences. We've talked about the MAC addresses. Ethernet checks frames, but it doesn't acknowledge them, so that's worth knowing. You can actually check and see whether you've got a bad frame, but usually if you get a bad frame, you dump it, and then the higher level protocols deal with it. It is possible to get CRC errors on Ethernet, especially if you've got a dicey transformer, transceiver, or too much noise on the actual Ethernet itself. There's no notion of a connection as such on wireless networks, but they tend to use a different sort of protocol. And if you look at the packet examples in the chapter, it will show you the different sorts of things that go into the wireless network packets, which differ depending on whether you're using an ad hoc wireless network or a BSS or a basic subset.
What was interesting was I did a wire capture on a Wireshark on using a wireless network, and I looked at the frames, and there wasn't any station identifier information. It was just Ethernet frames.
That is because, under Windows, your drivers will not pass the wireless headers up the stack. So if you're using Windows, you won't actually see the wireless level headers, and that's one of the reasons why it's very difficult to do wireless troubleshooting and stuff on wireless networks. That all sounds a bit wild over there. Okay, anybody got any questions on that stuff? Because that's all the notes I actually have for this lecture, although don't think we're getting away too early because I'm going to talk about the remote bundle for a bit and a few other things. So any questions on the actual prepared stuff for the chapter before I go on to the more interesting stuff? Well, relatively speaking, more interesting. Okay, and who's still awake? Okay. Alrighty, let's do that. Did you put your hand up for possibly, I know you're a busy person, Brian, did you put your hand up for potentially testing the remote bundle guff? Because I can CC you if you have.
Yeah, I think I did.
Okay, well, I'll assume you did, and I'll CC you anyway, and then if you don't get to it, it's all good.
I am.
I'm also interested in testing.
Yep, no, it's all right, Robert and Pranav and Josh, we know you guys are already on board to have a look at it. Alrighty, remote bundle and stuff, let's start talking about that. There are a couple of things that are, shall we say, somewhat advanced that you guys as exploration people get to play with. Now, I hope we all explained to you that the exploration was an advanced course. Did everybody tell you guys that? Exploration, advanced? Oh, good. Okay. Now, we have a couple of things you can play with, and depending on your time commitments and motivation and stuff, you can play with some of these or all of these, and some of these will teach you things, well, all of them will teach you things, and some of them will teach you some things, and some of them will teach you other things. Has anybody been into the virtual machines area on the website? And I'm about to give the password on lecture in case anybody wants the password. There is actually a virtual machines area where you can download some images of machines. So there's actually a Windows virtual machine, a Linux virtual machine, and yeah, there's a couple of Linux virtual machines, and there's a Windows 2000 and Windows XP virtual machine.
I there, think there, but apparently my memory of the password, username and password is incorrect. Since you're going to ask it anyway, I'll say what I thought it was. I thought it was VMware and images, but apparently it's not.
I changed it because we had a few ex-students that I didn't want getting back in there. It's now VMware and machines, okay? And that's why we told you to email us for the password, because I did actually make an administrative decision to change it about 2 weeks ago. Because the XP machines and stuff we've got up there have keys and stuff in them, we need to limit the distribution of them somewhat.
Fair enough.
So, a virtual machine is a machine that runs inside a machine. Okay, so if you've got a computer, it's actually a pretend, well, not a pretend, well, it's virtual. It's kind of a pretend computer. It has its own version of hardware. It has its own memory that's taken from the computer's memory. And it has its own virtual microprocessor. Has anybody played with an emulator before? Say, for example, MAME, the multi-purpose arcade machine emulator, or XNES, or perhaps you've run Infocom games on a CPM machine or even on a regular machine. So anybody played with an emulator?
There used to be something called Z Machine at some point for emulating something, or was that just a games interpreter?
You can probably have many hours talking to Drew about that, but essentially that was one of the languages that was originally pioneered by Infocom back in the early 80s. I think Zork came out in 1982 or 1984. I'd have to actually look that up. I think it was 84. And it used an assembler language called the Z Machine, and there were about 7 or 8 different versions of it that was actually cross-platform. It was a bit like Java. I don't know whether anybody's noticed, but Java byte compiles into something that is theoretically machine-independent, although the cynical ones amongst us for Java say write once, debug everywhere. Okay, so the whole point of a virtual machine is you can put this virtual machine onto your actual machine, and up on the Cavi website we have a Windows virtual machine with NVDA on it, and we have a Ubuntu machine with... it doesn't actually have a screen reader on it. You have to use TerraTerm to get to it, and I'll talk about that in a second. We could put SpeakUp on it, we just haven't, so I might actually whip one up with SpeakUp on it just so that it can make people happy. But as it stands, you actually SSH into the virtual machine, and you can actually, once you know the IP address of the virtual machine, and there are instructions in the document as to how to get that IP address, for the Linux machines, you can actually point a web browser at the IP address of the virtual machine /dwww, and it will actually pull up all of the Linux documentation, man pages, and stuff in user share doc in a web browser. And it's even got a searchy thing. So I think that's pretty cool.
Do they have webmin or something so you can like use GUI toys, or do you have to actually go play with command line things, which I like better anyway? But
I think I decided that I think there were some licensing wrinkles in the distributions of WebMin. I can't remember what the exact wrinkles were, but it wasn't sort of free and open. Like, for example, I know it's not integrated into Debian and Ubuntu. Whilst there are Ubuntu and Debian packages for it, it's not actually a core part of the distribution. So I think I decided that if students wanted web interfaces to administering their Linux boxes, that they would put WebMin on themselves. I suppose if you all give me a hard time, I could put WebMin on one, but I'm just going to have to check the license restrictions on that, because there was some funnies about it that I remember reading a few years ago. I'm one of these old school people that doesn't believe that everything should be accessible from a web browser. In fact, there are certain things that certainly shouldn't be accessible from a web browser, because they just don't meet the request and response sort of protocol that you have. So I tend to steer clear of web interfaces wherever possible. Some of them are quite good, and some of them are quite accessible, and some of them perhaps, like VMware Server 2.0's web interface, is not very accessible at all, which is why we're moving people towards VMware Player, which is up on the QCAT website. Alrighty, so they're virtual machines, and you can have a look at that. I've deleted VMware Server, just to discourage any of you from installing it on Windows 7. VMware Server has now been deleted, so don't install it. VMware Player is still up there, and the virtual machines are still up there, and I need to re-record the tutorials for VMware Player, unless anybody else wants to do any tutorials on how to get VMware Player up and running under Windows, and I'd be more than happy to let anybody sit down and record one. Otherwise, I'll do them.
Well, I haven't used it. Only used sort of Fusion and Server, but I'm happy to go get it and play with it. And if I can figure it out, I'm happy to record something.
Okay. See how you go. If you want to do a Fusion tutorial for the Mac, we've got a couple of Mac users. So see how you go, because even that would be useful.
Okay, Kerry, I gather the first thing to do for this bundle is to download a virtual machine. Am I correct?
No, the virtual machines, and this is why I'm talking about two different technologies, the virtual machines will allow you to do packet dumping on your local network using TCP dump, which is a command line Linux tool. And that is just one of the ways you can play with multiple machines. So if you want to build a peer-to-peer network with the virtual machines, you can put a couple on your workstation, and you can network those together. Now, to actually access the remote bundle, and this is what I'm going to switch to talking to about now, you need a thing called TerraTerm, which is in the extras section, and I will summarize an email to the announce list about this. In extras, you have TerraTerm, and you have some notes on how to configure TerraTerm. The best way to run TerraTerm is with the JAWS scripts that are provided up on the website, and you then also install the JAWS script. If anybody can find a way to make TerraTerm behave under another screen reader, we'd love to hear about it, but at the moment it's JAWS, and TerraTerm seems to be the best option at the moment.
If anyone's using, I don't think anyone is except me, if anyone's using Windows, I can do it. I mean, the cursor tracking once in a while is a bit flaky, and actually with the JavaScript, it's better. Hate to say that, but it is. But I can help if anyone needs that.
The labs still have to be modified, because they need to be modified to work within the virtual bundle, because we can't get Eagle Server to behave as we'd like to. We've got some technical connectivity issues. But for those of you who want to get your hands dirty in the virtual bundle straight away, there is actually some instructions on how to use the virtual bundle up in the extras folder. And there is a copy of TerraTerm that you get running. Basically, you telnet, and I'm going to say that with underscores, telnet to www.qcat.org. And that will get you onto the serial switch. The serial switch has 16 ports, and there's a screen that once you log in, you either log in as pod 1 or pod 2, and that will give you access to the machines on either side of the... okay, so what we've got in the pod, and I'll try and explain it, is we have three routers wired in a line. So we've got router 1, router 2, and router 3. On each of the routers, we have two virtual workstations. The virtual workstations on router 1 are workstations 1 and 2. The virtual workstations on router 2 are workstations 3 and 4. And the workstations on router 3 are workstations 5 and 6. Clear as mud?
What do you mean by wired in a line? I mean, whose LAN port is on whose WAN port and so on?
The routers actually have two high-speed serial interfaces, serial 0 and serial 1. So serial 0/0 of router 1 is wired to serial 0/1 of router 2. Serial 0/0 of router 2 is wired to serial 1/0 of router 3, and serial 0/0 of router 3 is wired to serial 1/0 of router 1. Oh, phew. So they're actually wired sort of in a loop, but one of the loop ends isn't configured, so you can actually cause packets to go round and round in circles, which is something you'll do as part of one of the later labs, because we want you to do that. But basically, router 1, 2, and 3 are connected together with serial links, and when you configure routers 1, 2, and 3 correctly, you can actually send packets from router 1, workstation 1, all the way through to router 3, workstation 5 and 6.
So okay, that's almost so a ring topology.
Hang on, sorry. What did you want to know, Robert?
So you're going to telnet to QCAT to www.qcat.org. I hope I got that right. And
yeah, you did.
And then you're going to use a user number and password, I assume, that you're going to supply us. And that connects you up to the bundle. Am I following all that? And I wasn't quite following
where
the pods come in.
Okay. A pod is basically a set of workstations. In each pod, you have two workstations, a router, and a switch. All of the things in the pod are connected to they're sort of one little network sort of section. So you've got workstation 1 and 2, router 1, and switch 1. So how do you actually what? Look, to be honest, guys, what's going to make a lot more sense is to actually, and I'll finish off explaining how this works, and then you guys will actually get to play with it over the next few days. Because you'll actually be able to use the serial switch, and you basically telnet into the serial switch and you put in either netacad 1 or netacad 2 to get into pods 1 and pods 2. So if you put in netacad 1, you'll get access to workstations 1 and 2, switch 1, and router 1. Yeah, NETACAD 1. But it's all written in the documentation, so if you miss that password, it will be written in the documentation.
And the documentation's in the extras folder.
I believe it is, and I'm going to make a copy of it into the exploration folder as well so that you guys see it in both places. Actually, I think the documentation is under general instructions, but I'll make some more links to it. So the actual programs are in extras and the documents are in general instructions because the bundle can be used by multiple courses, but I will make sim links across into other folders so you guys should be able to stumble across it pretty easily.
And when you're talking telnet, you're really meaning telnet through Terra term and not an old-fashioned telnet, as in DOS-based telnet command.
Well, you could use Windows Telnet, but as far as I recollect, the accessibility to Windows Telnet isn't brilliant, and it doesn't talk particularly well. But if you want to sit there with a JAWS cursor or a Braille display and use Windows Telnet, I will not stop you. If you also happen to have a Linux box at your disposal or a Mac and you wish to Telnet from either of those, I won't stop you from doing that either. However, I recommend Telnet with TerraTerm.
That sounds good. And the back to the Linux virtual machine, You're going to Teraterm into that too, I gather.
Well, the serial switch basically has 16 ports on it. And when you open up the connection to the serial switch, it will dump a screen that contains port numbers and a description of the port. So it'll say 03 router 1, 04 WKS 1, 05 WKS 2, 06 switch 1. And you go slash C6, and it says connecting to switch 1. Press Control X to exit. And you can actually connect to all different ports on the serial switch. And when you connect to each of those different ports, you actually get onto the console interface of either the routers, the switches, or the Linux workstations. And it is a true serial console, so you do get to see the output that would come up on those workstations once you are connected to that particular serial port. Now, as far as I recollect, the instructions for setting up TerraTerm are actually located in the general instructions folder. I will be linking these into the exploration area so that you guys can see them from both places. I'll actually create some symbolic links so that you guys can grab them from either place. But the instructions for TerraTerm and the remote bundle are in general instructions, and I will be updating those instructions today to make sure that they match the new remote bundle. There are actually two remote bundles in operation. One is at Curtin, and it has three routers, three switches, and one workstation per pod. And the one here has three routers, three switches, and two workstations per pod at this point.
So what would happen if, like, we accidentally sent a wrong command to one of these switches and kind of, you know, crashed it?
I would make you fix it. Okay, now I don't say that to be nasty, guys, but if you actually manage to get one of these routers into a situation where it is unbootable, if you have the time and we happen to collide in time zones, I will actually walk you through fixing it, because I believe that's a very good educational experience, and I believe if you happen to toast the iOS on a router, I will be getting you to TFTP the iOS back in. If the concept of that stresses you and you really can't cope with me helping you fix the router, which is fair enough, we're not going to hold it against you, I will go in and fix it for you. I will go in and fix the workstations for you. It's important to realize that this is a sandbox environment, and while some problems are easier to fix than others, it is possible for us to fix any problems that you students may inadvertently cause on the bundle. The bundle has no internet access. It's that simple. Once you get in via the Telnet interface, you cannot get back to the internet.
No, but couldn't someone get in through the Telnet interface directly? You know, someone did a port scan of an IP range, found the switch, got in and messed it all up.
But they'd have to know the passwords. Because as soon as you connect to the Telnet interface, you're asked for a password. So if you are bored enough, and I'm talking to you all out there, hackers on the internet, if you're bored enough to go through these lectures and find out that the passwords are Netacad 1 and Netacad 2, then we'll change the passwords. But, you know, the odds of that actually happening are fairly low. The reality is at the moment that we don't use SSH because our hardware doesn't support SSH. It's only got a Telnet interface to come into the serial switch. We use SSH for remote server administration, and we use it because it's secure. It's deemed that the Telnet interface into the bundle is a fairly low-risk thing.
Okay. Acceptable risk.
Well, we tend to think so, and we've got the images of the virtual workstations backed up on the server, and we've got all the configurations backed up on the server, so if things go pear-shaped, we can certainly resolve any of those issues. And yes, I did have a student one year that did manage to erase the iOS out of a router. probably the trickiest thing you're going to have trouble with initially is getting TerraTome up and running. You have to install, well, you don't have to, but you really should if you want to pass the course. You need to install TerraTome. You need to place the JAWS script into place under the version of JAWS that you're using, and you need to compile the script, which is about 4 lines long. Once you have compiled the script, there are 3 or 4 settings that need to be changed from their defaults inside of TerraTome. Basically, you need to tell it that you want the backspace key to send Control H, and you want the cursor to be either a vertical or horizontal line, because JAWS will not track the block cursor. And once you do that, TerraTome will behave a lot better with the JAWS scripts, but that is documented under general instructions.
Does anyone care if I use Secure CRT only because I'm lazy and it works flawlessly without any screen reader and not much configuration other than changing the cursor shape?
I thought CRT, just out of morbid curiosity, and you're welcome to use whatever terminal solution works for you. I just won't be able to answer your questions regarding Secure CRT if you ever have any. I thought there was sort of a slight problem with CRT where occasionally you would get the odd screen redraw, which is easily silenceable with a control key, but during certain things you would actually see a screen redraw.
I haven't with Windows, but that... since I went to a hosted solution, I don't use it near as much, but I think I'll play a bit. I have TerraTome anyway. I've had it for years. I use it all the time.
Okay. Well, if you're lucky enough to own a copy of Secure CRT, as you obviously are, it's, I think, about $50 or something if you want to buy it, but not everybody has a copy. If you are finding CRT works for you, or you have another terminal solution that will support Telnet that will operate for you, then you will find that you're welcome to use that, whatever you're comfortable with. The other thing, to answer your question, Josh, the answer to your question is, well, what port does Telnet run on? Do you know? 23. Well, that would be the port that you would connect to www.qcat.org on. Port 23.
Are there sort of iOS primers? I know they have some on the United States Books for Americans site, but for the rest of us, I wonder if there's like iOS primers any place that might be worth
reading. There is up on, I believe it's under general instructions, there's a thing called Ciscopedia, which is a list of all of the iOS commands and descriptions for all of the commands in CHM format, which is Windows Help Format. If you grab yourself a copy of 7-Zip, it is possible to unravel that CHM into HTML if you don't like Windows Help Format, but I really do, and the Ciscopedia has saved me on a number of occasions, and it's how I got our internet link back up and running when I had to put the Cisco router in and they changed all of the encapsulation on us at the ISP.
Yeah, no, CHM is nice. I actually really like it.
iOS is the Cisco operating system, and it's mentioned in one of the earlier chapters. You would have read about it. It's the Cisco Internet Operating System. So, yeah, there are sort of iOS primers. We're not going to get too heavily into iOS, but I'm not going to discourage any students from having a look at the Ciscopedia, because if you're going to continue on with us past Exploration 1, you brave souls, then you may want to avail yourself of an iOS primer. Such as the Ciscopedia, which is free.
One thing about the Cisco iOS, I've had a Discovery 2 course and actually had hands on a router. It's all command line oriented, which is really nice.
Well, if Windows 7 Ultimate 64-bit does not have a native Telnet client, I would suggest that you install TerraTome, which should function in 32-bit mode on your 64-bit operating system. It's worth a try.
It does have one. You just have to go into Add and Install Windows Features, or whatever they call it, and check it in the tree view, and it will magically appear.
Ah, well, that's good to know. Does it go on by default in the 32-bit version and just doesn't go on the 64-bit, or it doesn't go in by default anywhere?
I don't know. I will be back in 30 seconds. I will check.
Thank you very much. That'd probably be worth knowing, actually. I honestly don't expect you guys to be comfortable with the remote bundle off the bat. What I expect is for you guys to have a bit of a mess around and potentially hit a couple of brick walls and drop me an email and I will help you guys out. And then any feedback I get from you guys will go back into the documentation to make it easier for the next lot, because this is a new remote bundle and it hasn't been tried and tested a lot yet. I will also be emailing out OpenVPN keys to those of you who are on the testing crew. And the OpenVPN keys will allow you to get network level access to various devices, because what I didn't mention is that connected to pods 1 and 3 is actually a wireless router, and you can actually get into the web interface of that wireless router and configure it with OpenVPN loaded. The problem with having your OpenVPN connection up at the moment, and I'm warning everybody about this, is that once OpenVPN is connected, you are going to lose your default route to the internet. So you're going to have to knock OpenVPN out by going disconnect to get your network connection back. So some of you may wish to run OpenVPN inside a virtual machine so that you have internet connections from your actual machine. But that's a decision for you guys to come to, and we'll see how serviceable that is.
No, 32-bit does not have native Telnet either by default. I had to go add it.
Okay. I will keep that in mind then. So if you're running Windows 7 and you want to play with the Windows Telnet application, go into the add remove programs and features thing and add it in. Has anybody got any other questions that would be relevant? Well, the other thing I should mention to people too is that we'll announce it on the older lists, but the newer lists are going to move over to qcat.org. We're going to transplant our Mailman installation from gots.net across to mailman.org, and we've already worked out most of the curly bits to make that happen. And when that happens, I will have forwarding aliases in from the old lists to the new lists, but you will all have to go through your address books and smash the gots.net list addresses and put in the qcat.org list addresses, because eventually those forwards will go away. So this is just fair warning that the lists will be shifting to qcat.org, complete with all the archives, etc. Alright guys, I think that's all we have for today. I will work on updating that documentation and also adding in, going to look at modifying a few more labs, try and take the pictures out of the modified labs, because Josh says there's a problem with Word and the pictures, so we might make the picture go bye-bye in the modified labs, and I'll leave the unmodified labs around there for people who do want the pictures. And we'll see if we can't get a few more of these labs done and underway and rewritten for this remote bundle setup.